Yeah, thanks. Yeah. So here's the last entertainment for tonight and before the barbecue. So thank you for your patience. Don't go away. So the question I'm discuss, what a convex body look like, and of course the first reaction, what do you mean? I'd like to specify from the convex point of view. So for example, if somebody gives you, and I don't really discuss here, a convex body, how finite dimensional, how hard is it to decide for a given point whether it belongs to the body? And just to set up the stage so that the bodies that I'm interested in, the question looks completely hopeless, of course. So here is the typical we are up against you. So take the vector space where the body lives, the space all homogeneous polynomials, say, in n variables, so multivariate is essential, of degree 4. 4 is the first bad case, probably bad case. And take something like the set of all polynomials whose maximum absolute value on the unit sphere doesn't exceed 1. And this is a convex body, all right, even symmetric. But if I give you a point which is a polynomial, and you want to check whether it belongs to this convex body, then, well, it's a lot of trouble. The only thing we can say so far, it's a semi-algebraic set, so it's defined by a system of polynomial inequalities, presumably a very high degree. And to check something like that in a reasonable time looks completely hopeless. So then, of course, that would have been the end of the talk, right? But we can always sort of ask for an approximation. Well, how about we answer this question approximately? So again, so suppose that the convex body is symmetric about the origin. And the trouble of this assumption is that this is most interesting case. It's quite the opposite. It's just that I at least can say something here. But if it's not symmetric, then things become sort of even worse. And we'll look at the corresponding norm, the gauge, and I ask myself, so how hard is it to compute the gauge, the norm, approximately? Okay. And here is something that we can chew on. So, a first look, it's a classical result attributed to Lovner, John, and other good and great people. So that a convex body, a symmetric convex body, can be approximated by an ellipsoid. So roughly, it looks like an ellipsoid. And how roughly is it? Well, if we look at the corresponding norm, so it's squeezed in between two Euclidean norms, and the factor is the square root of the dimension. And the Euclidean norm is just a quadratic form. And it is easy to compute the value of the quadratic form because it has like n squared terms. And we just substitute the coordinates and do that. And then we ask ourselves, okay, so how about replacing this quadratic form by something computable, but other than quadratic? So can we get something better? And the first question, what if we just put here a polynomial? Can we get any better approximation? And here's a part of the answer. So, of course, for every dimension, for every degree of the polynomial, and we want to consider polynomials of even degree because we don't want to take the root of a negative number. So, there is a constant that tells you exactly what's the best possible approximation of any norm in that dimension by root of a polynomial. And here's a bound. of this constant. So it's bounded by that binomial coefficient, the dimension of the space, plus k minus 1 choose k, and raised to the power of 1 over 2k. So which effectively says that for any norm, you can find for any k, you can find a polynomial of degree 2k, such that if you take the root of that polynomial, it bounds the norm on both sides. So, and this constant is just this number. And for all practical purposes, this is roughly the dimension of the space divided by k, square root of that. Right, so in particular, well, we are certainly proud of that if we substitute k for 1, which corresponds to approximation with quadratic forms, we get something familiar. Right, and then if we look at it for... Yes? Well, okay, no. Polynomial of degree 2k, so, well... 2 times 1 is 2, so it's quadratic form. Yeah, this bound I can prove only for k odd, for some probably irrelevant reasons. Yeah, so for k odd. So the next will be a polynomial of degree 6. Okay. So, and first consequences are somewhat encouraging that something's happening in the right direction. So, of course, this coefficient tends to 1 as the degree grows, but in fact, if it grows superlinearly, right? Superlinearly, then the coefficient approaches 1. So we are getting tighter if we employ polynomials of higher degree. Then, there is something of a to cheer about. What if we just fix the degree and ask ourselves, so how close can we get? So which corresponds to fixing k? So then, essentially, by fixing k, but sufficiently large k, we can get a factor of epsilon times the square root of the dimension for any epsilon fixed in advance. And the importance of fixing k from a sort of complexity point of view is that, well, if you fix the degree of the polynomial, then no matter how many variables there are, you can compute its value fast because it has that many monomials, right? So, and the first consequence is that we can... approximating polynomial time with an epsilon times the square root of the dimension, which is by epsilon better than the square root of the dimension. So, and then we notice, of course, that we get a constant factor approximation that is just a constant as long as the degree grows proportionally to the dimension, right? But then there are, of course, disappointments that, it's all nice, but not as nice as one would have wanted. So you'd say that, okay, some norms are really approximated much better by polynomials. So if we take the L infinity norm, then we can approximate it by an LP norm much better. And then we can ask ourselves, well, maybe easily computable norms are well approximated, and norms that are hard to compute are not well approximated by polynomials. And this question is, I suspect, has a resounding negative answer. So let's look at the L1 norm. Which is, of course, doesn't take too much to compute. But when we try to approximate it to polynomials, so the fact that I checked for degree 6 only in non-trivial case, we cannot get better than the square root of the dimension, although with a different perhaps with a different constant, but it's still square root of the dimension. And the suspicion I have that 6 is actually any fixed number, that L1 norm is pretty resistant to polynomial approximation. The reason why is because when you look at this expression, you see that if the norm is symmetric, then you can always choose a polynomial that achieves the same type of approximation. You can always choose it symmetric. So, and L1 norm has a huge group of symmetries, a hyperoctahedral group, so you can assume essentially that these polynomials are symmetric and even contains all the variables in even degrees, so that the invariant under the action of the hyperoctahedral group, and therefore the choice is very limited. And just for 6, you can do it by hands, and I guess for any fixed K, you can do it anyway, so with a little bit of luck. So that's the first disappointment. And to tackle this disappointment, I suggest that we look in the proof and see what's relevant in the proof and what's not. So what I'm going to prove, this constant. The proof consists of 137 steps. This is a joke, right? So here's the proof. So I have my norm, and I look at the unit ball of the dual norm, and I'll tell you exactly when I'm doing something. It's like a lawyer in the trial case says, when I ask you a tricky question, I raise my hand. So I'll tell you exactly when I'm doing something. So far, I'm not doing anything. So the norm of an element is just the maximum over all vectors from the unit ball in the dual norm, and we take the absolute the maximum value of the linear function, right? And then I raise it to the power k and take the root of degree k, and I'm not doing anything yet. And then I say that, look at this, the k's power of a linear function. Can linearize it by writing it as a tensor product of k copies of the functional with the tensor applied to the tensor product of k copies of x, right? And I'm not doing anything yet. And then I'm saying that I can replace this maximum by the maximum taken over all linear functional from the convex hull of those powers. And I'm still not doing anything. And then I approximate, this is a convex body, and by the way, it's symmetric about the origin, and that's where the fact that k is odd figures in. So if k is not odd, it's not symmetric. And then I approximate this convex body, whatever it is, by an ellipsoid. And here I'm really doing something, right? I'm saying that's what the constant of approximation is. So you'd say that the whole thing lives in the k's power of the vector space, which is true, but it's not the whole truth. The whole truth is that it lives in the symmetric part, which is much smaller. The dimension is bounded by the very same binomial coefficient. So, and this is essentially the end of it. So, because what I say that now, if I take the maximum of the ellipsoid, what I get is the Euclidean norm of the tensor power of x, right? And the Euclidean norm is the sum of squares, but it's a tensor power, so it will be polynomial in the coordinate, in the coordinates of x. So that's just the square root of the polynomial in x, right? And that's the proof. So the main trick is here that when I tensor in, somehow I accumulate symmetries. And therefore, when I take the convex body, I take a convex body of the smaller dimension, which allows me to save in the long run exactly this much. Right. So this is the proof. Okay. So when the then the thing about this proof, we sort of start getting ideas that first that what exactly is going on. The polynomial that you get, you can write many conditions it would satisfy, like it will have this many contact points and other things. But on the other hand, if you really give me a convex body, then I'll have a hard time computing this polynomial because I'll have to tensor in, then take the convex hull and inscribe an ellipsoid. So we have to take care of that. Second, that there is some simplification or sharpening that I don't really have to take the convex hull of all tensor powers over all vectors from the unit ball. What I have to take only over extreme points of the unit ball. And this is a different number, this dimension. It can be significantly smaller than the hull dimension. And this is featured in several interesting examples. Well, interesting, again, from my point of view. So what happens if instead of the convex hull of the all tensors of linear functional, you take convex hull over just tensors of extreme points? So here's another example. Again, it features a convex body in the space of polynomials of degree 4, which is my favorite example because everything that can possibly go wrong there will probably go wrong. So we have a space of all homogeneous polynomials of degree 4 in n variables, so the dimension is roughly n to the 4. We fix a compact set in the space of variables, and we define the norm. So now it's the norm. It's just the maximum absolute value of my polynomial on the set. So it's a norm. Okay. So then I claim that this norm can be approximated by a polynomial and the coefficients of that polynomial f within this bound, which is better than the bound suggested by the general theorem, and it's better precisely because when you tensor extreme points, you get a better dimension. Okay, so this is a bound for this norm. So by the way, on the L example, that the reason that L infinity norm is well approximated by LP norm with this factor rather than within that factor is precisely, well, you can think of it as precisely because you can tensor extreme points of the unit ball in the dual space rather than the whole unit ball. All right. So there is a possibility for sharpening, though it's not sort of extremely... it's not really that much, but you can say something. So from a computation complexity point of view, you can argue that, so suppose you get a polynomial of a high degree that if it were a generic polynomial, it would have been hard to compute. But what if it's not generic? What if it has some symmetries? Maybe it's still easy to compute. And this is indeed the case. So the most general case I can think of is the following. So it works, of course, for particular norms, right? So the previous result was for any norm. So let me put it here. And this is for a particular, a very special norm, which does the following thing. So you have a Euclidean space with an action of a compact group, finite or infinite, and you take an orbit of this action. So, and the convex hull of that orbit pretty much will be the dual ball the ball in the dual norm. So what do? You define the norm as the maximum absolute value of the scalar product taken over the whole orbit. And then the polynomial that approximates this norm, fine enough, is just a familiar LP norm. So you just take the average, and you get this bound. And the bound is really unlike in the general case, where we get the same bound for the general norm. Here I can at least assert that for this particular polynomial, this is pretty much the best that you can get. So the exact statement is as follows. So take the space Rn with the action of the orthogonal group, just by rotations. Take a point, take an orbit, and that would be a sphere, right? Take a linear function of the sphere and take it maximum, which is, we all know how to compute. Then if you define this polynomial this way, then everything is computable, and you'll see that the right-hand side, or is it the right-hand or left? Yeah. Right-hand side is within the square root of 2 from the sharp bound. So no matter what k is, no matter what dimension is, so this bound is sharp within the square root of 2 at worst. So this kind of a redemption. So although I cannot prove that this bound is sharp for the general norm, I can assure you that for these very symmetric norms, if you take the LP norm, then the coefficient is the same, and this bound is sharp within the square root of 2. So, okay. Well, here's a corollary that I'm sure analysts know very well. So if you have a homogeneous polynomial of degree D, and you're introduce the L infinity norm, just the maximum value of the sphere, and then the standard 2k, L2k norm, then there is this bound, right? Which pretty much follows from this. Well, you a little bit trim down the dimension. So this is a bound that says how polynomials' maximum values are approximated by LP norms. And the interesting thing here from my perspective is that for some particular polynomials, you can compute this value fast, even if k is allowed to be large. So, namely, what do you really have to do? You have to raise the polynomial to the power 2k and integrate it over the sphere. And if the polynomial were a monomial, then you raise the monomial to the degree 2k, you get a monomial, you can integrate it fast. So we can compute the maximum value of a monomial of the sphere, but everybody can. But then we do something else. So we look at the few normal, which we look at the class of polynomials which, say, have not more than 10 monomial terms. And if we keep raising that to the power 2k, there is no exponential explosion because we started with a few monomial. Once we expand, we get a polynomial growth of the number of monomials, so and everything integrates efficiently. So the complexity corollary from that, it's easy to optimize few monomials on the unit sphere. So if you give me a few monomial that has this many, you fix the number of monomials, then in this class, there is a polynomial time approximation scheme to find the absolute value of this phenomenon on the unit sphere. And you may wonder why would anyone care to find that. But that you can use for solving, again, systems of phenomenal equations. You write certain barrier function, you integrate it, and you can test the feasibility of systems of phenomenal equations. So you can even make one more step in this direction. You say that I don't really care whether the number of monomials is fixed to be able to compute this norm. What I care about, if when I look at the Newton polytop or the polynomial, which is the convex hull of the support of monomials, it should have fixed dimension. Then when I started raising, there is no exponential explosion. Everything happens in the dimension of the fixed space. And I can, therefore, optimize polynomials in the sphere as long as, or as soon as, the dimension of the Newton polytop is fixed, remains fixed. Right. So, so on a little bit sort of personal note, so what we are doing really here, so we take a convex body and we're starting to carve in or out, if you wish, something computable, a computable part of it. And that computable part of it is not necessarily convex, but we have a certain leverage on how close it approximates the convex body. Of course, no matter what I say, the major disappointment is the L1 norm that we all know how to compute and that just absolutely resists all polynomial time approximations, right? So therefore, the following step is to look for something non-polynomial. And here I switch the gears completely, well, and I propose a P equaling P problem. So every mathematical theory should have its analog of the P equaling P question. That's sort of what unites us, right? So here I propose the P equaling P question in convexity, which is sounds like true or false, and if false, how false? And if true, is it true literally or sort of figuratively? Yeah, so is there a bivariate polynomial of two variables, such that for any, say, symmetric convex body in Rn, and for any epsilon greater than zero, I can find a polytop whose dimension is bounded by a polynomial in N and 1 over epsilon, and such that that polytop doesn't have too many facets. That the number of facets is bounded by, again, polynomial in the dimension 1 over epsilon, such that when I project, then I get something that lies within an epsilon from the convex body. So is it true for any convex body? Is it not true for any convex body? Or yeah. So, yes?
Why is it calling P equal to N?
That's a natural question. What does it have to do with P equal in P? And that's the topic of my next slide. So why? What are you hinting at? So what I'm hinting at here is that, well, from a complexity point of view, it's very easy to check if the given point belongs to a given polyhedron, as long as the polyhedron doesn't have too many facets. You just check all the linear inequalities. That's a class P, right? Class NP consists of projections of objects from class P, right? So in this case, it's, of course, if I even dare to ask something like that, can you approximate this convex body by polytop with a small number of facets? Or the dual question, can you approximate it by a small number of vertices? That everyone will tell me that no way. Right? Don't even try. Right? But I'm approximating by projection. And I'm trying to make the exponential explosion, the combinatorial explosion to work for me, so that I can get a polytop with whatever many facets or whatever many vertices by projecting sufficiently a reasonably small thing, right? And so the first sort of promising result in this direction is that the L1 norm that sort of bothered us so much is now taken care of, so you can get the octahedron as a projection of something relatively small with a few number of facets. But that everybody can do anyway. So there are less trivial examples, and I learned recently, just as recently as I think yesterday from Lasse, which is another one that's not here. So the less trivial, if you take the permutahedron, so you take a vector with different coordinates, you permute in all possible ways, you take the convex hull, then you get a polytope with n factorial versus and roughly 2 to the n facets. So, but then it's obviously a projection of the Birkhoff polytope, the polytope of the doubly stochastic matrices that has only n squared facets. So in principle, yes, of course you can get exponentially many facets from polynomially many. And the example that Lasse told me was the if you take the convex hull of all incidence vectors of the force, I think, in the graph, then it can be obtained as a projection of something polynomial or simple. Right. But here I'm just asking about sort of metric approximation. Yeah. And I'd like to, the last topic, I'd like to finish with a result. One amazing...
So this cannot be... This will give you... I mean, if you can find effectively such a...
Yeah, that's an interesting question. What does it really tell you, right? So, suppose that... if you can find this, right, then you can check whether the point belongs to the projection by solving a linear programming problem, right? So, does it imply that P is actually equal to NP? Well, not quite, because suppose I want to solve the traveling salesman or something even worse like that, then for any dimension, I'll have to do a hard work of constructing this projection, right? And this work may take more time than just to enumerate all the Hamiltonian cycles 10,000 times and choose the best, right? So,
can you repeat this main question that you put?
Yeah, okay, so let's... Yeah, sure. So, true or false? And, of course, that you should interpret figuratively. Trim it to be...
True or false figuratively?
Yeah. There exists a bivariate polynomial, so polynomial of two variables. One is the dimension, the other one is the degree of the approximation, such that for any convex, n-dimensional convex body, symmetric, there exists a polytope of dimension bounded by that polynomial, right, in the dimension of the convex body, and 1 over epsilon.
Polytope, don't care how many faces it
has. Facets. Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I do. Yeah, maybe I should...
This is a polytope, Q.
Right, yeah, such that its projection approximates a body within an epsilon, in
the number of facets is this Q? No.
The number of facets of Q, right, is also bounded by polynomials. So can I get something up there with not so many facets that projects neatly down there? Or the dual question: can I find a polytope with not so many vertices whose low dimensional section will give me a good approximation of that convex body? And I know of absolutely no reasons why it shouldn't be so, but I know only a few reasons why it can be so. And one of the reasons I am going to present. Yeah, so...
Zonotopes already satisfy you because they
projection of Q. Yeah, zonotopes are taken care of completely.
Okay, this is a picture. So this is generalization of this notion, say, for convexity.
Yes. But figuratively, not literally. of this following slide I'm going to share. Yeah. So...
So you say that, in fact, cross-polytopes became, from this point of view, zonotopes.
Yeah, for example, or you know, the Bermuda heterogeneous can think of something simple, too. So, yeah, so you don't get P equaling P, but if you get something interesting, you can get sort of non-homogeneous P equaling P, that there exists a series of algorithms sort of uniformly bounded, but in every dimension you have to compute your, you have to figure out your algorithm yourself. So, and that, oops, that's not worth it. Yeah. So, yeah, that's the signal. Yes?
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yes. Yes. So, so one of the reasons why it may be so hard to prove that P is not equal in P is because maybe it's equal, after all. In this, in for example, in this crazy sense that doesn't help anyone.
Well, you could have asked to find the big polytope also.
Well, I'm not so ambitious. No, no. Yeah, it's that's probably helpless, right? Because, well, because how this set is given. So think of this as a set of polynomials of degree 4, and that certainly gives you the right feeling. How are you going?
I would say the following, that in fact, even Zomato is okay just because some kind of theorem in convexity, which says that if any exists very good and small dimensional projection, which produces the same.
Right.
And so perhaps it is independent question for such generalization that if there exists some, then there is in fact almost linear.
Yes, so, and that's the topic of my next slide. Which I'd like to present something amazing, and as luck would have it, that's not a result of mine. So it concerns the approximation of the Euclidean ball by projection of something simple. So precisely by projection of a polytope with a few facets. How close can you approximate it by a projection of a polytope with a few facets? So we know that I learned it some time ago that the unit ball is a zonoid, right? So it shouldn't be too surprising that it's approximated by a polytope, by a zonotope, that is projection of a polytope. But the dependence of epsilon is like n times epsilon inverse. And what Bental and Nemirovsky proved is that you can actually get an exponential improvement on epsilon, that you can find a polytope in dimension, actually effectively linear in the dimension of the ball, and log 1 over epsilon. 1 over epsilon with the number of facets n times log 1 over epsilon. Not 1 over epsilon, log 1 over epsilon, which fits tightly. Right. And in the remaining 5 minutes, I sketch a proof. The proof is amazing, so it's sort of preview. It's one of these proofs that is so perfect that when you stare at it, it just stares back at you, and you have absolutely no clue why it's working. Right. So, they show that there is a paper, and I have it in my archives, the PS file, and it was published, I think. So, it may have been done earlier than that. And there is a story goes with that. So Nemirovsky and Haifa didn't have a solver for quadratic programming problems, but he had a solver for linear programming problems. And so he is known from his student years as a person who does everything by himself. So he said, okay, I'll take a quadratic problem and approximate it by a linear programming problem, and I solve it by my solver. And that's exactly what he did. Right. So, and he got this result.
So this was a really practical.
That was practical, and it's written. The paper is written in such a way that it not really publicizes this result, which I think is completely remarkable. But it publicizes that you can get along without a quadratic solver if you have a linear programming solver.
Basically, the idea is that you fix epsilon and let n be large, right?
Well, no, they both allow to grow.
If you fix n,
yes,
okay, and you let epsilon grow to zero, this estimate is not true, right?
If you fix it, it is true. You don't believe it. It's not a Zanatop. It's not a Zanatop. No, it's not a Zanatop. It's a...
Basically what you're telling me, fix and then you're going to get an approximation of D by a polytop with the number of faces, which is not one of
the... No, by the projection. Projection. That's NP power, right? By projection. So, the first step is, it's very sort of certainly clever, but it sort of still keeps you far away from the desired 1 over epsilon, is that's to reduce the number of variables. Essentially, to reduce everything to the approximation of the disk, of the two-dimensional ball. So, he says that, they say that they want to approximate the cone, the circular cone instead of the ball, and then we just split, like for example, if we had 4 variables, we split into 3 inequalities and we deal with them separately. So we approximate each of these 3-dimensional circular cones by projections, and then we combine projections up there to project down in here, which is not very hard, because you have just to identify some variables out there, and this is a linear operation, so it just imposes a linear constraint up there. So essentially the question boils down to approximating the 2-dimensional ball, the disk, within log 1 over epsilon, and that's where you stare at the proof, and the proof stares back at you. And so... here's a nice picture. So consider the disk, and we want to approximate, say, the first quadrant, because all of them are the same. And what I do, or what they do, I just enjoy it. So just looking at it. Right, so they take a point, any point in the first quadrant, and they say that, let's play the following game. Let's first rotate it by pi over 4. If by any chance it gets into the negative half plane, we reflect it back. Then we got a point, obviously, which forms the angle of pi over 4 or less. Then let's rotate it by pi over 8. If by any chance it goes astray down there, we flip it back. Then each time we divide the angle by 2. And sure enough, after this many steps, we'll be in the epsilon neighborhood of the point 1, 0, right? Now, the only point now is to just model the rotations by projection of a polyhedron. And the rotations look exactly like this. So it's a matrix with constant coefficients, right? Applied to repeatedly to vectors, different matrices, but with constant coefficients. And in the y-coordinate, you take the absolute value to flip your point back. And now you just, well, we know how to write the absolute value as a combination of linear inequalities, right? Something like that. Well, you play a little trick. You put a greater than or equal to sign here, and then you do something else. So please consult the paper. But that's the idea. So that's how you make n linear in log 1 over epsilon. And if you look at it and ask yourself, so why does it work? Well, it works, but why? Sort of on a deeper subconscious subliminal reason. We don't know. Right? I don't know. So, for example, Nemirovsky conjectured that you cannot get this log 1 over epsilon approximation for other convex body, and he had a particular example in mind that brought up today in disguise by Gil Kalai, the convex compact set of positive semi-definite quadratic forms with trace 1. Yeah, he conjectured that if anything, that particular thing cannot be approximated by projection with the dependence log 1 over epsilon. And the reason he conjectured, because he doesn't believe that So my definite programming solver can be replaced by linear programming solver. Right. That's pretty much it. Thank you.
Maybe you should steal the linear programming solver of Milovsky to develop a better linear programming algorithm.
How? Especially on the 1 to 1, Sunday, 4:30 in the evening, we have some kind of discussion, perhaps about this question.